everyone. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today when we get to talk about my favorite subject, food, and everything that is involved with our food choices today. We've got a great topic today. We're going to be talking about food policy, obesity, and healthy school food. My guest is Michelle McCabe. She is a research assistant at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. She works with Roberta Friedman, Director of Public Policy, to research and create policy briefs and maintain the legislative updates. Michelle advocates for a healthy school food environment in her town. She is in her second term as chair of the Fuel for Learning Partnership, a PTA Council Standing Committee that serves on the Wellness Coalition, organizes educational events around nutrition and local food, and seeks to improve school lunches and school food policy. Michelle received her bachelor's degree from Vassar College and her master's degree from the University of Texas, Austin, both in art history. Welcome to It's All About Food, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, this is a really heavy topic, no pun intended. Those things just come out, and I never realize what I'm saying. But we have such a problem today, and it is very complicated. So many things are connected to so many other things. It almost seems impossible to solve.
No, certainly. The childhood obesity epidemic is, there are many factors involved, and certainly no one solution is going to fix the problem. It has to be addressed in multiple ways and in multiple environments.
Yeah,
and school is clearly one of those.
School is, it's so important. So we have the government, and they have their policies. Some of them are good, and some of them are not so good. We have the media that's promoting us to consume all kinds of things. A few of them are good. Most of them, I think, are not so good. We have parents who are typically both working, big schedules, overwhelmed, not eating well themselves, let alone knowing. Somehow I don't know if humans ever really knew what was right to eat, but we're certainly very confused now. And then the schools are struggling just with their own education policies, and then they have to feed children. It's just, and then there's this profit motive kind of hovering over everything. And it just makes it so overwhelming.
Yes, it's funny that we're finding ourselves in a situation where the easiest, convenient, and least expensive way to eat is unfortunately also the one that puts our health most at risk and leads to many health problems. You know, some are connected with obesity and some are not. And it's very overwhelming to consider how are we going to change an entire culture, really, that we've become around food, and how do we change that environment where the easy, the least expensive, and the most convenient choices are also the healthiest ones? And
well,
that is the subject of a lot of the work that is being done by the Rudd Center.
Well, it's interesting because you chose a number of words there that I think are worth talking about. One is easy, and the other is least expensive. And I think there's a lot of debate around those words, because what some people think is easy in terms of convenience foods or grabbing things, if they thought a little bit more about it, what goes into those foods to get them so that they're just accessible is not very easy at all. There's a lot
That's
of manufacturing
true.
And a lot of people involved to package foods and get them so that we can just pop them in a microwave. And it may not be environmentally friendly, and certainly may not be healthy. And then this expense thing is so connected to our government, our governmental policies making some foods more affordable and other foods not.
Yes, it's true. And in a way, it's falsely inexpensive, because what makes it inexpensive is not ultimately sustainable. And I think, too, there is a misperception of cost as well, because there have been studies that show that actually buying whole foods and fresh foods is not more expensive than buying prepackaged, pre-prepared foods. I mean, most of us know that to prepare a meal at home, for example, is less expensive than to buy one out at a restaurant or even a fast food place.
Yeah, there's nothing cheaper than beans and rice.
That's exactly right.
I mean, really.
Ew.
Now, maybe we want to try something different than rice because now we're hearing about arsenic in rice, but I digress.
I know. It just doesn't end, does it?
There's, you know, every food has a story, I like to say, and not always a good one. Okay, so you've got a lot of challenges. What is the Rudd Center focusing on? What are some of the things that you're doing?
We're focusing on a lot of different directions, most of it trying to equal the balance that we just described, looking to make it easier and affordable to make those healthy choices, and to also try to address the sort of, like I said, the false inexpense of certain things. Like one of the initiatives that is being studied by the Rudd Center is a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages,
mm-hmm.
Because that particular food product has been shown to have a very clear link to a lot of health problems and obesity. Unlike other food products, there is no nutritional value in sugar-sweetened beverages, and we are just simply drinking a lot of them. And we don't have the mechanisms biologically to be able to feel full. So in other words, you may drink hundreds of calories of a beverage, but it's not the same as eating 100 calories of something else where
right.
you might feel full and then you're ready to stop. That mechanism doesn't work as well with liquid beverages.
It seems like a great place to start. And here in New York City, of course, Mayor Bloomberg has been working on taxing he wanted to tax, and that didn't work out. And then now he's trying to avoid the extra large sizes of beverages, and he's getting a lot of pushback from that.
Yes, it's difficult because, you know, we, I think as Americans, like to rely on our own choices to determine what we're going to buy or consume. But I think part of the interesting question here is, you know, you're looking at someone who's trying to make those choices smaller, but there are also people that are actually interfering with our judgment by making the portions larger.
That's such an important point.
Yes, and so, you know, there have been many studies that show that, you know, people will consume what's in front of them. And so, you know, your choice is being taken away if everything that's being presented to you is extra large as well, or you're being persuaded by other factors like the value meal, for example, or where the products are placed in the grocery store. I mean, they really are kind of working against your personal choice. And so this is just someone trying to do the same thing but for the benefit of your health. So
yeah, there's a lot of education and empowerment that needs to happen where people recognize that they're being manipulated.
Yes, or just how nice it would be to be able to walk into a store or to go to a restaurant and feel comfortable that the choices that you're being presented with are not only tasty but also aren't going to jeopardize your health in any significant way. And I think that's one of the great things about the school environment as,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of those places where we really can make a big difference. And it's both, and that environment should be, especially because we're dealing with children who are still developing, who are learning about choices and learning about what is appropriate to eat, that those places be sort of those utopian environments where neither the parents nor the students nor the staff have to even worry. They know that what's being put in front of the kids is really good, both really
yeah,
good for them
concept.
And really good to taste.
I know.
Isn't
that weird?
Concept.
You know, it's so obvious that if we walked into a place and we were hungry and it only had food that was good for us, we would find something that would satisfy us.
Absolutely.
And it's really a no-brainer, and yet we don't seem to get there. But also, I'm sure you're up on some of these. There have been some articles in the news lately and some activity going on that is just kind of nutty. So there's been this fight, I guess, against the No Hungry Kids Act. I'm backtracking. The USDA put out some guidelines a couple of years ago about maximum calories of dishes for meals in schools.
Yes.
And you know, sometimes we try and solve problems and then we make more problems. I have a personal feeling, and I guess it's hard for schools, but I don't think we should be focusing on calories. But that's another story.
I think that, you know, what's interesting about the situation that's going on right now with the calorie caps, there have always been calorie minimums. These, first, the school food regulation, isn't actually, the idea of it isn't new, and this is just a revamping of them that occurred with that Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010. But, and there were always calorie minimums because the program was initially developed to help with malnutrition in our country. And, you know, the calorie caps are actually quite generous, and it has been shown that the kids are actually calorie-wise getting more than what they had been getting previously before the ironically.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it's a lot, and especially looking, if you're looking strictly at the high school, it's quite a lot of calories. I think what the schools are having more difficulty with are really the grain and protein, how much they're allowed to be giving in those particular areas of the lunch program. And I agree that it is complicated and it is difficult. I think that we really need to commend food service directors for, you know, working with these guidelines and trying to give the kids with very limited funds, you know, the best meals that they can. I think that a lot of the hoopla over it, some of it is just about misinformation and misunderstanding than an actual reflection of what's going on.
What about, I read another article where, okay, there are more fruits and vegetables being offered, but basically kids are just throwing them in the trash.
I'm so glad you brought that up because it's been causing a bit of consternation, I think, those articles, simply because we really don't know what's being thrown away. We do plate waste studies here at the Red Center, and they're very, very involved, as you can imagine. I mean, to really understand what's being thrown away, you basically have to not only dig in the trash, but you have to weigh things. And what they have found is that people are predisposed, especially if they're not doing an actual research study on plate waste, they are predisposed to see what they are expecting to see in the garbage. So, for example, there was a study that was done where they were looking at flavored milk versus plain milk that was being consumed in a given school. And even the researchers themselves were assuming that, you know, it was probable that the flavored milk was being consumed while the plain milk wasn't. And what they found when they actually measured, they poured out the actual milk, and you can imagine what a messy job this is. The students were consuming and throwing away the exact same amount of both. There really wasn't a difference. And I think the point, one of the sort of tangential points that was made in this, was that people are going to see what they're expecting to see. If folks are expecting to see fruits and vegetables in the trash, and sometimes for good reason, you know, they don't want them to be in the trash. They're not looking to, you know, blow the lid off of anything, but they're actually just concerned. They will see fruits and vegetables in the trash. And a lot of the information that's going around in the press isn't based on someone actually doing a measurement. And also, as far as I know, I don't know what studies are out there that was looking at this before the regulation compare. And plus, there are a lot of other factors, too. I mean, you can imagine that it depends on what fruits and vegetables are being served. I know that, you know, sometimes they'll get something fresh and delicious and that kids really like, and sometimes it could be coming out of a can and it's just not very appealing.
Yeah.
So there's so many different factors that jumping to a conclusion, unfortunately, I think, undermines what the point is, which is kids need to eat more fruits and vegetables. And I can't imagine that people don't want kids to be eating more fruits and vegetables. At least I hope not. So it's almost, it's too bad because it's not, you know, it's October,
mm-hmm.
and anyone who has children knows that it takes a while for people to get, kids in particular, to get used to new things and
yeah.
get used to new foods. And rather than, you know, getting all excited that things have not worked out or have failed, I think we need to recognize that things take time and we need to be supportive and then make an actual evaluation that's valid.
But that needs to be incorporated in any plan. And every time I read about these different programs, it seems like it isn't. And it's well known in the food service, food system establishment. You need to introduce a product numerous times in happy environments for people to
yes.
ultimately request them.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think that there are plenty of school districts, most of them, I'm sure, unsung heroes
mm-hmm.
quietly
yeah.
working where they're working that are doing a lot of great things to ensure that the food that they're making is being eaten and to make students in particular part of the process. There are districts that, for example, will do sampling. They are districts who will have committees that students are actually a part of. And they work with the food service directors on menus, and they do tastings as well. Those are the situations that aren't necessarily getting the widespread press as more, I don't know, as the garbage cans, for
right.
example. You know, there are places that really are doing a great job trying to ensure that the kids like the food and that it's healthy, not just, well, the kids like chicken nuggets, for example, so that's what we're serving. You know, there are districts that are working to get kids to enjoy better-for-you foods.
Right. Education is so important. We know that. And the schools are struggling so much with their curriculums and programs and effectiveness. But kids need to learn about food. Why? What's good for us, why it's good for us, where it comes from, how it's made. So many people have no idea where their food comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I know one 13-year-old who was telling me he's reading Chew on This by Eric Schlosser
mm-hmm.
in his school, and you know they're learning about a lot of heavy things that I think it's important kids know about. Things like factory farming and where their food comes from. You know, hamburgers don't grow on hamburger patches.
Right.
Yeah. And when they're educated, they're more empowered to make the right choices.
Yes, and sometimes actually it's the children that are coming home and educating the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Myself included, and I think that's sometimes, you know, a really wonderful way that people learn. You know, they go, I remember my youngest was in a preschool where they spent a whole week tasting different vegetables. And it was both an exercise in food and nutrition, but it was also a math exercise because they were graphing and charting. But what was great was when parents picked the children up, there was a chart hanging on the front door, and I learned that my son, for example, really loved red peppers. I had no idea.
I was just going to mention red peppers. They're like candy.
Mm-hmm. They really are. They're delicious. And it was so great for me as a parent. You know, it's not as though, I try to put different things in front of them. But here, he tried it in a new environment. He may have liked it more because of the fact that other kids were enjoying it, and he was doing it at school, and it wasn't his, you know, mom telling him to eat everything on his plate. But it was a great opportunity for both of us to learn something.
It's interesting that parents don't realize how often their own opinions affect their children. And so if a parent doesn't like a food and doesn't include it or sees it serves and kind of scrunches up their nose,
yeah.
the kid feels the same way, unfortunately. So it's great that they have an opportunity to try new foods outside of the parental atmosphere. Allergies
mm-hmm.
is another piece of this very complicated problem. And more of us are allergic or sensitive to different foods, children, to the point where it can be fatal sometimes.
Yes. And I know that's very difficult for many schools and cafeterias to accommodate. you know, it is definitely a challenge that's becoming more prevalent.
How did we get to this place? Is this something new, or are we just, you know, did humans always have these allergies, or is it because we have so many new Frankenfoods and manufactured foods? Do you have any idea what the cause is?
Well, I know that this is outside, certainly, of our scope of research, and I don't know, and I know that there are people that are working on it. You know, for me, I'm looking at it from the exact same level of expertise, I imagine, as you are, mm-hmm. in the sense that I don't know, but it does seem certainly like there are more children and adults who are exhibiting certain issues and allergic reactions to food. There's no question about it. You know, I think there are a lot of, I'm sure that there are a lot of things going on with our health that are connected with our food that we don't even know about yet.
Right.
And I imagine now that people are really focusing on it, we're going to learn a lot more. Because, you know, I imagine some of the things that are being used, it's not as though people have done any testing on them. So, you know, we don't know.
Yeah. We don't test enough on so many things. And then once they're out in the food supply, it's kind of hard to isolate which ones are causing a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you are involved in policy and legislative updates. How difficult is it working with the government to make change?
Well, we work mostly, we work more as an educational provider for legislators or other folks working in government. I mean, what the Red Center does is focuses the research we do in such a way that it can actually, that it's actionable in the form of policy. And so, for example, if we go back to sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, our economist here at the Red Center created a tax revenue calculator, for example, that could show how much money a state could make were they to levy an excise tax. They, you know, model certain things to see if consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages would decrease were a tax to be put in place. So what we do here is really provide the science to support the change that can occur in government. For me, we have a tool that's available on our website that is a database of legislation that's related to food policy and obesity. And for me, it's just interesting to see how difficult it is just for things to pass.
Yeah.
You see hundreds of bills introduced and so few of them actually make it through. That it's a slow process. But I think what is wonderful when it does happen is that when something is a policy, then it has the potential of influencing so many people and having a positive effect, excuse me, for many people for many years. And I think as slow as it is, it's a positive way of making positive change.
There have been a number of books out lately about the French culture and bringing up children with the French culture and how much better they eat. And I'm not sure if I agree with it or not. I lived in the south of France for 4 years, and I've seen children and their eating habits. They seem to be a lot better than here in America. Are you familiar with any of those, and do you have any feeling about how our culture versus other cultures affects our eating habits?
This is, again, speaking as a person, as a researcher, I am familiar with that, and with the books that have been not only on food but also on parenting. I don't know if you've seen mm-hmm. there's a whole book on how French parents parent compared to Americans. I think we definitely do have a different relationship with food. There's no question about it. You know, having spent some time in Europe, I mean, even just how they spend their meals is just so incredibly different from ours, and of course they have, you know, a longer tradition, a longer culture.
I heard we only get 10 minutes for kids to eat in some schools.
Oh, I know. If that is, I have to say, that is a huge, huge problem that is very concerning to many parents, myself included, mm-hmm. and one that it's very difficult to come up with how to solve it. I mean, the staff and teachers at schools today are so strapped to get all of the curriculum taught. I know instructional time is at such a premium that it's hard to figure out where in the day they can carve out more time for lunch.
Yeah, oh gosh.
But kids are really rushing through it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You're involved with your PTA Council Standing Committee on the Fuel for Learning Partnership. It's so important when parents get involved, and the PTA can really be a powerful place to make change in individual schools.
Absolutely, absolutely, especially when the PTA and parents are working in partnership with food service and staff. It's phenomenal, the amount of change that can take place, and it's very important for them to work closely together. And that's what we have found. And the more educated a parent is on what the issues that a food service director, for example, is dealing with, it's so much easier to come up with a plan. And also the parents are there to build support for it. You know, again, if we go back to what you had mentioned with the press and all of the backlash that's occurring with the new nutrition standards, it's so important that the community stands behind them. And PTA and PTO and other parent organizations are, as you can imagine, poised to be able to provide that support, because ultimately we want the students eating it. And so it's been a real honor and privilege to be able to have worked closely with our school administrators through PTA, where I live and my children go to school, and try to make a difference.
You have how many children?
Three. Yes, three boys. They're all in elementary school.
Oh, goodness. And are they good eaters?
You know what? Actually, they pretty much are. They are good eaters. It's each of them, they don't all like the same things. But there are certain, you know, fruits and vegetables and things that they all, you know, each of them like. And but, you know, I think they're also pretty typical as well. You know, they're not so, but they are good eaters, and I'm very lucky that way, because it's difficult when you're struggling and you just want your child to eat something.
Right.
You know, they're on their way to school and you're practically begging them just to put anything in their mouth, and I can see why. It ends up being very stressful. And also, you know, when you had brought up the point about, you know, two parents working, and certainly if dinner time, for example, is one of the few times that everybody's together, I can understand why nobody wants it to be a battleground over who's eating their spinach or not.
Right. Or even when you're tired, to have to think about, okay, what am I going to start making?
Oh, yes. It's a huge challenge, and you know, it's a huge challenge. I mean, I'm personally, and as you can imagine, very interested in all of this, and I work very hard to serve the kind of food that I want to my family. But I can't honestly imagine many people having that level of diligence, because it's just too hard. It's very time consuming.
Yeah,
it's very time consuming, and so.
I like to come up with ways to help people so that they can prep a lot of things on the day off, work with kids, and make different things that they might freeze and have along the week. And there are ways to organize things and do some time-saving steps, but it requires effort. It requires education, and it requires practice, and it requires a want.
Yes. I mean, the truth is, at the end of the time, you know, once you get into the groove, I think it becomes a lot easier.
Absolutely.
But it is a learning curve that is hard. But, and also, there are so many great technological advances that help, like a slow cooker.
Mm-hmm.
I rely on heavily. And actually, I just started using a bread maker.
Right.
Bread machine,
there you
which,
go. Yeah.
It's been really great, and so it's pretty fail-safe, and that's been a lot of fun. But it does make things a lot easier once you can leverage some basic kitchen equipment.
That's right. There's a lot of things that can make things easier, where you're making fresh, whole, minimally processed, very clean, healthy food that tastes good.
Right.
Michelle, thank you very much for joining me on It's All About Food. I'm really glad you're doing the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my nonprofit website where you can find lots of healthy, delicious recipes. So many of them are easy and will help you in your journey to eating better for you and your family. We'll be right back with the second part of the show.